Accession number 28353, Reel 6.
Peter, you were describing the deployment to Canada. Mm. If you could.
This was due to take place in sort of April time. And as I say, we were going to take the aeroplanes across there. The Germany squadrons would take them on to Cold Lake from the eastern coast of Canada. We would then go out, do our part of the exercise, and bring the aircraft back. And so whilst we were in Norway in the sort of the February, March of that year, we were busily thinking about this significant deployment exercise across in Canada. However, when we got back from Norway in March, of course, we suddenly were confronted by the invasion of the Falkland Islands on the 1st of April 1982. I think few of us knew precisely where the Falklands were at that stage, so our ground liaison officer got out maps and so forth, and I mean, it clearly was a very long way away indeed, and there didn't seem to be any possibility of us being involved. People were talking about a naval task force and things of that nature, but it didn't seem to us that that would involve us at all. People jokingly thought it might be quite nice to deploy to somewhere in South America, in Brazil or somewhere of that nature, Rio de Janeiro or somewhere of that nature, and be held in reserve there. But as that wasn't on offer, then we just went back to planning this exercise in Canada. But fairly soon after that, so within a week, so by about the 8th of April, which sort of coincided with the Thursday, I think, before Good Friday of that year, we suddenly got a warning order which said that we were to prepare elements of the squadron, numbers undecided, to be deployed to act as attrition replacements for Sea Harriers lost in combat. It was thought possible, at least, that the Royal Navy would lose up to one aircraft a day from combat operations, and as they only had a finite number of aircraft and crews, they needed their aircraft to be replaced with something else as they lost them, even though the two aircraft are significantly different. The Sea Harrier was predominantly designed for an air-to-air role, although it has a ground attack capability. The Royal Air Force Harriers at that stage were designed predominantly for air-to-ground, but had an air-to-air capability, but they could not at that stage carry an air-to-air missile. And they had no radar, but they did have forward-firing guns. So in the period sort of over Easter and after Easter, we started preparing for a deployment where we really knew very little about what we were going to be expected to do. Nobody knew what numbers of aircraft were required, how we were going to operate, whether we were going to operate embarked or ashore, what our role was going to be, and so forth. In the meantime, the Royal Air Force had already started to provide some pilots for the Royal Navy to bring their aircrew-to-aircraft ratios up to an appropriate level, and a number of people with previous Lightning experience were posted into the Fleet Air Arm with the ability to fly the Harrier, but also with an air-to-air background in order to do their role. We, as I say, were obviously planning for a deployment the size and scope we didn't really fully understand at that stage, and at the same time we started to try to train up in those sort of areas where we thought we would be needed. So we did quite a lot of operational low flying. We campaigned hard to get an air-to-air missile fitted to the aircraft because we thought we would be used in the air defence role, and much to the credit of industry and our own procurement people, it took just over 3 weeks to get a missile fitted to our aeroplane where there had been no wiring, no plans, nothing to actually fit an air-to-air missile before on the aeroplane. It had been fitted, and we had trialled it. We'd been across to Aberporth. We'd fired AIM-9Ls from the aeroplane against towed targets and proved the system, and that was a remarkable step in the right direction.
What is an AIM-9?
The Sidewinder missile. We'd done quite a lot of operational attack profiles with the range of weapons that we normally carried. We thought the exercise in Canada would be cancelled. We were sure it would be cancelled, but the Air Force didn't cancel it. So we flew the aeroplanes across. We flew some aeroplanes across to Canada, left them on the eastern side of Canada, and came back and got on with planning. But actually, that was very good because some of us, myself included, had not done any really long legs, and the 6.5 hour leg from UK to the eastern side of Canada was a very good experience for what came later. So that was actually very useful, though I was actually extremely surprised at the time that the Air Force continued with that particular deployment. We went down to Yeovilton and qualified ourselves on the ski jump, for embarked operations. At the same time, and serialistically, there was a BBC TV series being filmed called Squadron, which was the story of a composite squadron. It was a specially constituted squadron which had Harriers, Hercules and helicopters all in a single squadron, rather like a special force of some sort, and it was held at readiness to go round the world for trouble spots and things of that nature. And we were tasked to provide quite a lot of the Harrier filming for that particular series, which used film stars and things of that nature for all the key roles, because there was the love affair and all of that sort of thing in it. But again, the Air Force didn't say, no, look, you chaps are concentrating, we've earmarked you to go to the South Atlantic. They said, no, keep doing that. So we had people all over the countryside doing different things, preparing themselves and the unit for this deployment, the size and shape of which we still didn't fully understand. So it was a very hectic and busy period, enjoyable in some ways, but by golly, an awful lot of things were going on which required you to be quite alert to know what your own people, where they were and what they were doing. The Air Force said to me, when we've decided what numbers you're going to go as, you can take whoever you want from the Harrier force. So you choose your team and you can take those people. So if you want the most experienced people in the Air Force flying, you can take them. And I said no, that I did not want to do, that I wanted to take people that I knew. Not that I wouldn't have known some of those other people, but people I knew very well from my own squadron. And I couldn't see any reason for not taking a range of experience levels. I didn't particularly want to take the A team, as it were. I wanted to take a range of experience levels from across my own squadron. That said, I did actually take one person back who had only just recently left the squadron to go to the operational conversion unit as an instructor. I asked for him to come back so that I could send a balanced team. But at the end of the day, when they eventually came down and said how many people were to go, I was able to take 8 pilots, which was what the size was eventually, 6 aircraft and 8 pilots. But they went from a chap who literally just been made combat ready up to myself. So it was, again, a balanced team of experience. And that then left a second balanced team under the command of my deputy, because there was a thought was that there would be a second team to come down later at some stage. So eventually we got to hear that it was 8 pilots, 6 aircraft and just 19 ground crew. The ground crew, really their job, because it was still thought that we would be attrition replacements, the job of the ground crew would be just purely to tell the Royal Navy engineering personnel the differences between the two aircraft, so that we just took some expertise, not that they would be required to do all the work on the aeroplanes, because the Navy would lose aeroplanes and therefore they would have plenty of Matelots to do the servicing on ours, but they would need guidance and direction. And so the thought was still, as I say, that we would be attrition replacements. the date of departure and so forth sort of kept on sort of going backwards and backwards and backwards, but eventually we got the sort of the movement order, and the first of our six aeroplanes left Wittering on the 7th of May, 4th of May, 1982. We flew them that night to St. Morgan, stayed overnight at St. Morgan before flying on to Ascension Island the following day. And the Ascension Island legs were sort of 9-hour type sorties to get us down there with tanker support. And then when we got 8 aeroplanes down to Ascension, we had a couple of days there before we put the aircraft, or flew the aircraft, onto a ship called the Atlantic Conveyor, which had been transformed from being a container ship into a transporter of everything military. And eventually, when it left the waters off Ascension Island, it had 6 of my Harriers. It had another 8 Sea Harriers, which had been sort of dug out from various places. It had something like 6 Wessex and 4 Chinooks embarked in it. So I mean, it was carrying quite a lot of aeroplanes. It had 5 car decks below, out of sight, and they were loaded with weapons, with stores of every conceivable nature. So it was an immensely valuable ship. It had all the steel planking that we needed to build a forward operating base at some stage on the islands, so a colossal amount of equipment and stores. And we set sail from Ascension on about the 7th of May, evening of the 7th of May, in convoy with the rest of the amphibious task force. So the LPDs, the Landing Platform Docks, Intrepid, Fearless, the LSLs, Sir Tristram, Galahad, and so forth, and a number of the ships taken up from trade, like the Atlantic Conveyor, like the Norland, and so forth. And so there were about, and one or two escorts. And so we had about 19 or 20 ships in this convoy heading south, and actually quite an impressive sight. Early on in the voyage south, we had a Sea Harrier held at high state of readiness on the metal pad on the front of the ship to, if necessary, get airborne, go straight to a tanker which would support us out of Ascension, refuel, because remembering you can't get airborne with much fuel from a vertical takeoff, refuel straight away, and then go and shoot down the Argentinian shadowing aircraft, which was tending to shadow us from time to time, their 707. But in the event, it was never actually scrambled, and then we got too far south for tanker support to be available to us. And so, but nevertheless, the concept of being able to use the Atlantic Conveyor, not just as a transporter of aircraft, but actually a platform from which to operate, is again shows the remarkable flexibility, I think, of the aircraft. What we'll be doing on the way south, what were the things that were important to me as commander, were to carry out a lot of briefings with my team of 8 pilots. First of all, to get somebody from the Navy to tell us what it was going to be like flying from a carrier, because none of us had got any experience of, you know, what were the procedures, how would we go about it, what would be the routine on board, but also to discuss a variety of other things, how we were going to go about the whole process of accepting unserviceabilities, to what degree were we going to bend, if you like, the peacetime rules in terms of carrying snags on aircraft, abiding by safety limits that we had normally used, and so forth. So that was important. Would we, you know, demand to operate at a 10 to the minus 6 level, or would we go to a lower level of safety? To what degree, you know, would we low fly? What heights would we actually fly down to? And then things like conduct after capture. How would we respond to being captured? Just reminding ourselves of what we ought to say and what we ought not to say, and so forth. So really quite a lot of quite serious briefings, which had a logistics aspect in the fact that I and one other were the only pilots in Atlantic Conveyor. The rest of my pilots were in another ship. So whenever we wanted to get together, we had to get a helicopter to go and pick them up from Norland and bring them to the Atlantic Conveyor so that we could have a meeting, and then they would get taken back again afterwards. The other major event that was going on the voyage south was trying to get a technical means of aligning the aircraft's inertial platform on a moving deck. The inertial platform, absolutely essential to provide accurate navigation and accurate weapon aiming. Without the inertial platform, no navigation aids, so very much back to a map and stopwatch, and no inertial weapon aiming, so just a fixed cross in the head-up display and having to aim off for all wind and things of that nature by just judgment. Ferranti had designed a piece of equipment which looked a little bit like a TARDIS, which would be wheeled up and down the deck, plugged into the airplane, and in theory this would allow us to align these inertial platforms on a rolling and moving deck. When we left UK, we thought it would work. On the way south, trying it out in the Atlantic Conveyor, it showed that we didn't. And we had a small team with this piece of equipment communicating the whole time with Edinburgh. And sadly, they never did manage to get it to work. But that was a key effort during the sort of the 14 days or so that we were steaming south to try and get it to work. And sadly, they never did. And so at the end, we were left to sort of map and stopwatch and fixed cross only in the head-up display, which was a great shame for all the work that was put into that. But and it took them a long time, even after the conflict, to get it to work. So there was a technology issue which they clearly just haven't quite got their minds around. On the way down, I suppose apprehension amongst the team. At the same time, and military people are funny, because when they're told to go off and do something like that, although they're not necessarily keen in themselves to do it, they don't want it to be cancelled. And there was undoubtedly a feeling of, here is an opportunity to put our training into practice. We have trained for years and years to do something, and fortunately the Cold War has remained a Cold War and we've never been allowed to do it. Here maybe, so we don't want Haig and others finding a solution which will stop us doing it. And I think actually that feeling still applies to those in Iraq today. They wouldn't necessarily choose to go to Iraq, but having been told by their politicians that that's what you're going to do, they would be equally disappointed if it were to be cancelled. And I think at this stage, in 82, as opposed to now, when people have actually been on combat operations for a long time and they've all got rows of medals to prove it, the South Atlantic conflict was something totally unusual, and there were people, you know, screaming and shouting to try and get involved in it. I just don't want to be a staff officer, I want to be in a... So there was immense sort of almost competition to get onto the team that went south. So I think we would have been greatly disappointed if Haig had managed to wind it all down, and we obviously listened to the World News Service as to his jetting around trying to find a solution. And I think actually I was surprised that he didn't find one. I thought he would. I thought by the time we got there, he would have actually diffused the whole situation. Until perhaps the last day or so, and then it appeared that he wasn't going to manage to do this. So we arrived down there on the 18th of May.
Where exactly did you arrive on the 18th of May?
We arrived in the total exclusion zone around the islands, in visual sight of the carrier that we were going to embark into. And my six aircraft were going to go to Hermes, and the Sea Harriers were going to be divided equally between Hermes and Invincible, four to each. And the process of, from the deployment down there, the Navy hadn't lost any Sea Harriers, or very few, lost a couple to accidents, but none to enemy. It was decided that we would be used as reinforcements and not replacements, and rightly, we would be dedicated to the ground attack role. They would assume total responsibility for the air-to-air role. So we transferred our airplanes by vertically taking them off and then landing in the carrier on HMS Hermes. And that started a sort of an eight-week period when we basically were embarked in the ship. I think to understand really quite what went on, what needs now talk a little bit about the sort of the relationship between the Air Force and the Navy at that stage. At operator to operator level, everybody knew each other because all the Sea Harrier pilots came through Wittering for their Harrier training with us before they then went on to the Sea Harrier. So really, most of the people in 800 Squadron, which was the squadron in Hermes, I knew and knew pretty well, and we all got on pretty well by and large. I don't think the Navy, they had wanted reinforcement with air crew because their manning ratios were not adequate to man the aeroplanes they had, and therefore they had to accept. And actually 25% of the pilots flying Sea Harriers in 82 were Air Force pilots. I don't think some of the Navy wanted an RAF unit presence in their ship, because I think they wanted to be seen to be doing this on their own. This, of course, was in the immediate aftermath of Knott's defence review, Command Document 8288, which was going to sell Invincible and things of that nature. So I think Henry Leach and others saw this as the way of saving the Navy, and therefore they didn't particularly want the Air Force much involved in it if they could possibly avoid it. Thank you very much. And therefore, at the sort of a command level, there was something of an antagonism. The captain of Hermes was a Fleet Air Arm pilot, a chap called Middleton, who certainly had a distorted view of the Air Force. Quite why, I will never know, but he did. And indeed, it was made clear to me fairly early on, in fact the first evening that I was embarked in the ship, that Middleton would go out of his way to make my life as difficult as possible. Which was a sobering thing to be told when you first arrived.
Who told you that?
One of the senior members of the ship's officer company took me to one side. And indeed, we had to an extent sort of seen a bit of that when we first embarked. I was the first one to land in the ship, then my two flight commanders arrived. As soon as I arrived, I was met by the captain, who said, right, we've got to get you briefed up so that we can get you flying. So I was taken off to a briefing room where I was briefed on ship procedures and things of that nature. The next chap arrived, got the last half of the briefing, and the third chap arrived and got the last 5 minutes of the briefing, and then we were put on deck alert. We manned up the airplanes, deck alert, and just for a training sortie, wasn't going to be a combat sortie, and so we briefed up for it and so forth. And we were held at deck readiness until it went dark. It got pitch black. I'd rebriefed the sortie. I said, all we're going to do now is just get airborne, dump fuel, and go round for a carrier controlled approach and land. And eventually, some half an hour after it was completely dark, we were stood down. Now, that would have been our first launch ever from the ship, and our second landing. I mean, extraordinary that the captain, and I think he did it just again to a degree to impose his will and let us know that he was very much in charge. And there is no doubt that within a carrier, the command element within a carrier has total authority, And as a squadron commander, so the officer commanding of 800 Squadron, really had very little autonomy within the ship. Whatever the commander air and the captain said went. Even to the point of, I've seen people ordered to take off even when they've reported unserviceabilities, which would normally allow them to get out of the airplane saying this airplane's unfit to fly. But the captain and the commander air have said, no, as far as we're concerned, you're to launch. And that's really quite different to the culture of the Royal Air Force. And therefore, the squadron commander, my opposite number in Hermes, really, yes, he had administrative responsibility for his people, but in my view, no real command responsibility, because that was vested in the commander air, and that he was nothing more than a senior pilot on the squadron. And this is where it comes back to the point that I was making before in terms of the site commander responsibilities, whereas I had always envisaged, even on one squadron, when the concept was different, but I was going to be running this air base at Vandel or at Tromso, that I probably wouldn't fly. Here I was suddenly in a situation where I wasn't part of the command, I was now answerable directly to Commander Air, and therefore again, to all intents and purposes, I was just a senior pilot, slightly different to my naval counterpart, because there were aspects about our operation that the Navy didn't understand, so they did need advice on how we were to be used and to best effect and things of that nature. But nevertheless, a senior pilot, which therefore allowed me, unexpectedly, to do as much flying as anybody else. And that was something I had not actually ever expected. I found it extremely challenging and rewarding in many ways, and I'm delighted that I had that experience, but it wasn't something that I had anticipated. Things which sort of gave me concern, quite apart from the fact that the captain was likely to make life difficult, I mean, he was a bully, of that there's no doubt, but if you stood up to him, as you do if you stand up to most bullies, and if you're talking sense and he can recognise that, then he wasn't that bad. But if you gave in to him, then he would continue to bully you. And if you gave him wrong information, then he would be very severe. But going back to the sort of the point, we eventually managed to get laser-guided weapons into operational use in this particular conflict. For the very first time, the Air Force had never used laser-guided weapons for real. And so trials were carried out in the United Kingdom as to what profile would best be used to get these weapons into the trajectory to achieve the right guidance parameters. And that was all trialed in the UK, and the details were signalled to us in details. You know, you need to run it at this sort of speed, at this sort of height. This was quite a lengthy signal when it came through, and Middleton had me up in his sea cabin that night, and he tore me off an absolute strip. He was a South African as well. He would not have his communications channels being blocked by these great books being written by the Air Force on how to... And I said, but hang on, I said, this gives us the details of how to use what could be a battle-winning weapon, because we will now be able to take out targets with some precision. And he had to accept that. But in his first instinct... But I'm sure he did it because he didn't want us getting the profile. He didn't want us getting sort of any publicity over this. Another example, for example, we deployed with 6 aeroplanes. We lost 4 to combat losses. 3 shot down, 1 crashed at the forward operating base. Of the 2 that we had left, there was one which was quite badly unserviceable. So we only had a single aeroplane. And so we called for further reinforcements. And the only way we could do that now was to actually, because the Atlantic conveyor wasn't available, was to tank them all the way to Ascension and then all the way from Ascension to the carrier, with the possibility that if you couldn't find the carrier or something like that, you'd have to jump out over the side and crash the aeroplane. And Middleton vetoed it initially. He actually turned round to his admiral and to the Air Force and said, I will not have it. Reason? Because he thought it was a sheer publicity stunt by the Air Force. Not that we needed reinforcement, but that here was the Air Force trying to seek publicity by deploying all the way using air-to-air refueling to land on a carrier.
And what was Sandy Woodward's response?
Well, Sandy Woodward overruled him in the end. Well, I mean, it took some discussion. It wasn't an issue resolved in 20 minutes. I mean, it took 2 days to resolve. Initially, the answer was no, they will not come. But at the same time, we had lost an aeroplane quite early on in Jeff Glover's being shot down over the amphibious area of operation. And this, if you like, was quite an interesting issue. When we did peacetime type exercises simulating war, if an aeroplane on startup of a pair went unserviceable, you tended to say, well, in war we wouldn't send a singleton, but for peacetime we'll send a singleton because it's a waste of hours and that sort of thing to shut the other aeroplane down and things of that nature. And so we would go through that sort of decision-making process. Glover and I were tasked on the morning of the 21st of May to go and provide airborne combat air patrol over the amphibious area at Port San Carlos. I went unserviceable on